and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Hotel Captain Cook for author Peter Kagayama's talk entitled For the Love of Cities. Recorded at the For the Love of Anchorage workshop hosted by the AUDC, hear from Peter Kagayama, co-founder and producer of the Creative Cities Summit and author of the book For the Love of Cities, next on Addressing Alaskans after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Kagayama, co-founder and producer of the Creative Cities Summit and author of the book For the Love of Cities. Peter Kagayama was the featured speaker at the For the Love of Anchorage workshop hosted by the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation on Thursday, February 23rd.
Thank you very much for coming out. Thank you, Anchorage. I have to say, live, work, play, you're right. When they started to tell me about how this was going to sort of play out, this is a bold undertaking. I mean, you know, taking, say, not only just to be, you know, good in all these things, but really to be the top U.S. city by 2025. But I suspect that that is in your nature to do big and bold here. I think it's maybe something that has to do with the quality of this place. So good on you for taking that on. And as Mike said, you know, some people want to address maybe a certain aspect of that. But again, you guys are trying to address it in its totality. And frankly, that is the only way to do it, because you can be the best sort of work environment. You can have the lowest taxes, the most up-to-date whatever infrastructure for business, yet if the amenities that go with that and the quality of the time that people spend away from work is not the greatest, they're not going to succeed. So these things do have to be addressed in totality and from a very holistic approach, and so I do applaud you for doing that. I want to just quickly thank Bill Pop and the staff at AEDC. They've been fantastic to work with, especially Megan and Emily. You guys have been great, so thank you so much for taking us all around. We had a great time yesterday. I want to sort of point out my partner over here, Michelle Royal, who is going to be our graphic recorder for the event, the workshop afterwards. So she's busy prepping this, what's going to be a mural that's going to capture all of the ideas that we're going to talk about this afternoon after the workshop. But before we get there, I'm going to share with you sort of the basic premise, if you will, of my book, For the Love of Cities, and give you guys a little bit of background as sort of where this conversation about cities is at. Sounds good? And I guess we'll take it from there. In March of last year, there was a wedding in Durham, North Carolina. And like most weddings, it had brides and grooms, it had dresses, it had tuxedos, it had flowers, it had cake, and all of the typical amenities. Unlike most weddings, it had 1,600 brides and grooms, and they weren't marrying each other. They were marrying the city of Durham. In what was described as the largest civic union in history, these 1,600 people got together and they pledged their oath of love and fealty to the city. And their oath included a promise to keep the streets clean and safe, to vote responsibly, to support local arts and culture, to buy local, and to protect the environment. And what was interesting about this is it wasn't started by the city. It was actually started by a woman who apparently just absolutely loves the city of Durham. And somebody said to her, as we do, says, well, if you love it so much, why don't you marry it? And she goes, good idea. And she actually pulled this off. So all volunteers, and they decided they wanted to raise a little bit of money, because you actually had to buy a wedding license in order to participate. They took that money and they said, we want to raise about $12,000 for local charities. They more than doubled that and raised over $25,000. Pretty cool. At the same time, right around that same time last year, Dave Bing, the mayor of Detroit, receives a tweet, because the mayor is actually on social media. And the tweet suggests, it says, hey, Mayor Bing, how about a statue of RoboCop for the city of Detroit? RoboCop being that movie from 1987 set in a very dystopian Detroit. To which the mayor politely but rather tersely replied, thank you, but there are no plans for a RoboCop statue in Detroit. Too late, because by the time he practically sent that, the idea was already out there. And literally within a matter of hours, people in Detroit are buzzing about this, saying, well, why don't we have a statue of RoboCop in Detroit? That'd be really cool. And so they set up a Facebook group, and they decided to go out and raise the money themselves. Instead of like going to the city and asking them for money or going to the Arts Council, they said, no, we'll raise the money ourselves. And they used Kickstarter, which is this online crowdsourced fundraising platform where they can go out and raise money in $5, $10 increments and things like that. And despite what the local media called irony run amok, they raised over $67,000 to actually build the statue, and it's actually going to happen. Again, all volunteers. Now, what do those two stories have in common? Well, they begin with people, citizens, who are going above and beyond the ordinary definition of citizenship and doing something kind of extraordinary for their cities. And I believe that it is when people have this emotional engagement, when they love a place, they're far more likely to go out and do something weird and wacky and fun and beneficial to the community. Now, you would think that this would actually be a fairly common sort of emotion, fairly common in our communities. Actually, turns out it's not. Gallup, in conjunction with the Knight Foundation, between 2008 and 2010, did what they called their Soul of the Community Survey. And they interviewed over 40,000 people in 26 cities, and they were basically taking the temperature of the relationships that people have with their communities. And what they found was actually pretty sad. They found that 40% of people would identify as being unattached to their communities, 36% said that they were neutral, and just 24%, less than one quarter of us, said that they were attached to their community. Now, attachment is not love. Attachment is maybe you vote, you're a member of the local community watch, and you volunteer once a year at Thanksgiving at the homeless shelter. Congratulations, you're attached. That's not necessarily very warm and fuzzy. So what they also found at the same time they were asking these particular questions was very interesting. They were correlating this to economic data. What they found was really interesting. The places that had the highest levels of passion, loyalty, and attachment also had the correspondingly highest levels of local GDP and economic vitality. Think about that. Gallup was not going to go so far as to say these were causal, but clearly they were one of those interesting statistics that move together. And all of us know from our own businesses and our organizations, when certain statistics move together, we pay attention to those. And the fact that love matters really shouldn't surprise any of us. When children are loved, they thrive. Same too with pets, plants, and objects. And I do mean objects. And like many of your cars right now, this probably looks kind of like, I grew up in Ohio, so I'm very familiar with cars that look like this in February, covered in road salt and a little dire need of a little bit of repair, a little bit of love. But this car probably represents the typical nature that most of us have, the nature of the relationship that most of us have with our cars. We treat it like a tool. It gets us from point A to point B, and maybe we do the scheduled maintenance, maybe a little late. We wash it occasionally, and it's functional. It gets us from point A to point B, right? And I imagine a lot of cars here in Anchorage look like this right now as well. And that's probably a pretty good metaphor for the way people feel about their relationship with their cities. They treat it in a very functional manner. But we all know people who are absolutely in love with cars, right? They're the ones who are out there on weekends when it's warm. They're out there, you know, waxing it down with a diaper. They change the oil even if they haven't driven it an inch. Right? These people love those cars, and they look and feel pretty darn different than the cars that most of us drive, right? And why? It's because those people have invested some of themselves, some of their emotional content, some of their identity, some of their love into that object, and it clearly shows. Now, don't you think if we invested a little bit more of our love and our identity and our passion into our communities that it might not shine a little bit more like these cars? I think so. Now, I've been asking this question, what do people love and what do they hate about their cities for a long time now? What's really been interesting is to hear the uniformity of some of the answers and how wildly different some of the other ones were. The answers that were very common were the things that people hated about their cities. Those were actually very common. And what I found out is that people hate big things. Hey, big intractable problems like traffic, like parking, like a bad education system, like poor design. Big intractable problems that you could spend a ton of money trying to fix, and people would say, well, you know, it's not quite so, you know, I'm still not happy about this. The problem is that you could, again, spend a lot of money on these things, but they don't necessarily engender a whole lot of love. And nothing maybe symbolizes that more than the pothole. Right? I imagine you guys have some monster potholes up here, right? Everything is bigger in Alaska. So I imagine that people probably feel pretty, you know, strongly. It's like, hey, fix the darn potholes, you know, you're driving to and from work. And I liken the pothole to sort of like a hangnail or a paper cut. Hardly life-threatening, but really, really irritating, right? The problem is that we as citizens, we complain to, you know, city council, the government to fix the potholes, government responds, and they think that is sort of the nature of the relationship that we have. You know, we complain about potholes, they fix potholes, and that's sort of how we want to interact with our government. I can tell you this. You could fix every pothole in Anchorage, and people would say, well, thanks, the streets don't suck quite so bad. You get no love for fixing the potholes. And we spend an inordinate amount of time focused on fixing those potholes. And it has to do with the orientation of what we think about sort of as the core of the city. Of course, your city has to be both functional and safe. That is sort of the minimum threshold that we have to achieve. But if it was just about, you know, police and fire service and paved roads, there's absolutely nothing that keeps us in one place versus another. And I think all of us recognize that we aspire to something more. We actually want our cities to be comfortable. We want them to be convivial in the sense that they help bring us together. We want them to be interesting, and perhaps more importantly, we actually want them to be fun. Those are the things that actually inspire us, and those aspirations shouldn't necessarily be seen as nice-to-haves. Those are actually kind of critical to the process. Now, a lot of people would say, well, we don't have the money to do this kind of stuff. Well, what I'm going to show you is actually that these kinds of things, these small things, this love, comfort, and conviviality don't necessarily come with big price tags if we get a little creative in how we think about this stuff. Because what people responded to, what they loved about places, they tend to be small things, intimate things, very personal things. Maybe it's a little park, someplace where you walk your dog, your favorite place to people watch, a great local coffee shop where you can just sit and read a book. Small things like that. And in the book, I liken these to a love note. Now, at some point in all of our lives as men, we learn that the handwritten note that goes with the gift is pretty darn important. Maybe much to our surprise, first time we give a gift to our significant other without the note, we learn very quickly. That's pretty important. That small thing has an outsized impact on the way somebody feels and the way they receive that gift. A love note to the city is a small thing that has an outsized impact on the way we feel about that place. And I've got a few examples. If any of you have been back to New York City in the last couple years, you've got to go and check out pedestrian-friendly Times Square. In the past, you'd go to New York, and you'd go to Times Square because it was the ultimate place to people watch, look around, see everything. It's sensory overload. The problem was, in the past, if you went to Times Square and you took one step off the curb, you were going to get run over by a cab. And if you stayed on the sidewalk and you stopped, you were going to get run over by a New Yorker. It was a bit of the devil's choice, right? So what they did was actually fairly extraordinary. In the busiest intersection in one of the busiest cities in the world, they said, no, we're going to push the cars out and we're going to make this into a pedestrian-friendly zone. They brought in chairs, they brought in Wi-Fi, and is now the ultimate place to actually sit and people watch. It's actually pretty extraordinary. So, and in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of New York, this is a small thing, and I highly encourage you to go check that out. And while you're there, you should also go down and see Highline Park in New York City. Highline Park is in the Meatpacking District in Lower Manhattan, and it's this elevated train track that's about a mile long, and for over 30 years it sat empty. They couldn't figure out what the heck to do with it. A lot of people said, oh, tear it down. Other people said, no, redevelop it, make it this. Well, a group of volunteer citizens actually led the charge again on this, and they decided, no, we want to make it into a park. We want to make it into some elevated green space in a part of town that really very much needs more green space. And you wouldn't think that being just two stories above the city would totally change the way you see the city. It absolutely does. It's incredible. You go up there, you're walking around, you see these grasses, these flowers, these small trees, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of people walking around with you. It's absolutely wonderful, and it's had an incredible impact on this part of town. People want to move down and be near the High Line. Now, it's sort of the interesting lesson that every community has that weird white elephant that people go, what the heck are we going to do with that? And maybe if you flip it around a little bit and start looking at it, it's like, well, what would happen if we got something really weird and did something kind of crazy, like make a train track into a park? Interesting idea. And again, in the grand scheme of New York, a small thing. Millennium Park in Chicago. Any folks been to Millennium Park in Chicago? Yeah. Tell me, does this sound familiar when you went there? And this is actually called, called Cloud Gate is the name of this big art piece. But everyone locally calls it the Bean, because all good public art actually gets a nickname. And think about that. If you've got public art here that doesn't have a nickname, it means it hasn't quite resonated. It isn't quite weird enough, fun enough, whatever enough. So ask yourself, does this public art have a nickname? And I think if it does, I'd say that's a success. But what happens when people approach the Bean? They walk up to it. Tell me if this, you know, this sounds familiar. You walk up, you found your reflection. You take your picture. You stand in front of it. You have people take your picture. You take the skyline. You see kids underneath of it because it's like this giant funhouse mirror, right? Fun. Play. Now, right next to it are these two towers that have these video faces on them, and the faces actually change. And during the summer months, these water cannons shoot water out into this park, and it's like an above-ground pool, and you'll see hundreds of kids playing there. Play. Think about how important play is in the context of our relationships with our friends, family, our significant others. It's those unplanned, unstructured moments when we're just at ease, play. Those are the bedrock of our relationships with other people. Yet, how do we think about having a relationship and playing with our city? We need more opportunities to play with our city, which is why live, work, and play is writ large there. You know, people think, oh, play is kind of something for kids. Well, it's really not. Play is incredibly important to us. And I got to have, you know, commend you that, you know, I think you've done some pretty good examples of that. And play can be small. Now, Millennium Park is a big love note. It's a $475 million love note. And I recognize most communities don't have that money just lying around. But you can go small and do some really cool stuff. This is the street pianos project that started in England. What they do is they take these pianos, they basically put them out in the street with a sign that says, play me. You sit down, you bang away on some notes, like, okay, that's kind of fun. But occasionally you actually get somebody who knows what they're doing, and it creates this impromptu street concert, and it can be quite wonderful. Now, maybe it's just a couple of minutes, you stop and you listen, but you remember this stuff, and you smile. And never underestimate the importance of a smile in our day-to-day life, that this actually is one of those little things that absolutely enriches our city. So play. And I have to give you credit for that. We were walking around yesterday, you know, in downtown. We saw the ice sculptures. And I understand they've been up since December, and they're maybe not at their best right now. But that didn't seem to impact the way kids were feeling about that. They were still having a good time. And when kids have a good time, parents have a good time, right? And I thought what was kind of fun here was this is Michelle. And that's actually pretty cool.
That's really cool.
Little things like that. You know, we had not seen something like that. So good on you for doing that. Play is important. Think about how important that is in the context of our relationships. And think about more opportunities that we can create play in our community. This is the new Tampa Museum of Art. It's been open about a year and a half. It's in downtown Tampa. It's right on a river. And it's really kind of cool. Neat architecture, cool collection and stuff like that. But the museum itself, actually, they did a couple of small things that I think are actually pretty important. One is they put this dog park out back of it, right along the river, and right out in front, there's a playground. Now, in the grand scheme of things, of course, you know, we'd like to think of ourselves as very, you know, high-minded. Of course, I always go to the museum, right? Well, how often do we actually go into the museum and have that experience? You know, a couple times a year, maybe. But on a day-to-day basis, that dog park and that playground get a heck of a lot of use by citizens who absolutely love that aspect of it. Now, you need to have the museum there to anchor that. But those two elements actually humanize it in a great way. And I'm sure at some point somebody said, do we really need that dog park? And isn't that, you know, that playground really just a lawsuit waiting to happen? And fortunately, they said, no. These are two elements that are absolutely critical to the success of this museum. So small things like that, a little amenity that's added on like that, can have an outsized impact on the overall quality of that particular place. And I bet there's got to be a farmer's market in pretty much every city in America, right? You guys have a farmer's market? Of course. Now, do we really think about how important those are? Because it's like, oh, that's kind of cute. Well, this is the downtown Saturday morning market in St. Petersburg, where I live. And it is, you know, they'll get 10,000 people there on a typical Saturday, 120-plus vendors. And I like to say this is where St. Petersburg goes to meet itself. You'll see people down there with their kids, people walking their dogs. The former mayor used to go down and play his guitar at the market. Pretty savvy political move, by the way. You know, the mayor playing a guitar, that's kind of cool. But you're guaranteed to run into people you know. So think about your little farmers markets that people say, oh, you know, that's kind of, you know, nice. Those are actually the kinds of things that we absolutely love about our communities. And they're probably undervalued and underappreciated. Now, a few more things that make, you know, cities lovable. I kind of like this. I found this in your gift shop, actually right across the thing over here. So a few more things that make cities lovable. Rituals and traditions. Any folks here ever been to Providence, Rhode Island? No? Oh, back here. This is actually from Providence. This is a little event there they call Water Fire. And it's been going on for 15 plus years and was created by an artist by the name of Barnaby Evans. And it's pretty simple. They anchor these braziers in this river that runs right through downtown into this round lake that's downtown. They anchor these braziers, they put these cords of pine wood in them, and they light them on fire. It's water and fire. It's the most basic thing in the world, and it's absolutely magical. Because when you go down there during Water Fire, that happens at dusk and it goes into the night, you smell the pine smoke, you hear the crackle of the wood, and it creates these wonderful dancing shadows because it's all that moving light. I mean, think about, you know, how we've probably sat in front of a campfire or been to a bonfire and been absolutely mesmerized, right? There's something in our human nature that responds to that. Now imagine taking that to a whole municipal level and you have Water Fire. And I was actually lucky enough to participate in what they call a lighting ceremony a few years ago. And like the villagers out of a Frankenstein movie, we carried these torches from City Hall down to the river. We put the torches into this big urn, and from that urn they actually light all of Waterfire. Now, this happens about half a dozen times a year. Locals absolutely love it, and if you're a visitor, you want to go to Providence when a Waterfire is happening. It has become a ritual and a tradition for them. Zombie walks. Has there been a zombie walk here in Anchorage? Yeah, okay, most communities have had zombie walks. And for those of you who don't know, a zombie walk is a very slow-moving parade. People dress up like zombies, you know, they shamble, brains. And really good zombie walks have designated victims as well. You know, somebody who's dressed very normally, and maybe I've got like goat entrails stuffed in my shirt, the zombies descend upon me, much screaming, entrails flying, blood, you know, fun. Not necessarily for everybody, I get that. But what's interesting about this is that this is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Pittsburgh and zombies kind of go like this. Anybody know why? Little movie called Night of the Living Dead. Remember that? George Romero, 1968, Night of the Living Dead, and then the movies that follow on, especially like Dawn of the Dead, which takes place at Monroeville Mall, which is just outside of Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh has become sort of zombie mecca. For the folks who are into this zombie culture kind of stuff, they started World Zombie Day. They originated the zombie walks, which have now spread literally all over the world. But what I think is kind of cool about this picture, by the way, I got this from the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. They've embraced this idea. They said, no, we want to bring the zombie walk to downtown Pittsburgh because it's a local and it's an authentic tradition for Pittsburgh. They said, no, we want to make that part and parcel of what we're doing. Pretty darn cool. So figure out what is the local rituals and tradition. This is a nice one. Orlando, the city of Orlando, which is actually not Disney. Everyone thinks Disney is Orlando. And Orlando, the folks from Orlando will say, that's actually Kissimmee. That's not Orlando. They have this round lake down there called Lake Eola, and for several years this fountain lay dormant, lay quiet, because they couldn't afford to fix it. I guess they were figuring they were going to fix some more potholes instead of fixing the fountain. But Mayor Buddy Dyer last year said, no, we're going to fix the fountain. And so they fixed it. It's got these lights. There's a little music that goes with it. Creates this whole sort of show. And people loved it. When the fountain came back, people responded. They felt good about their city. And I'm sure you could have fixed a lot of potholes for maybe how much it cost to do that, but the impact that people had with the simple relighting of the fountain was pretty profound, and people will go down there on a nightly basis just to be down around that fountain. Now, you guys have a pretty cool ritual and tradition here that I understand is starting tomorrow, and I'm very excited to see Ferrandi. So that's the kind of thing that outsiders, tourists, we absolutely love this stuff. I can't wait to see the reindeer run. Michelle is dying to see a moose. We understand there was one in the hospital that we visited yesterday, the night before. We just missed the guy. But rituals and traditions. Think about how much you guys actually, you love these kinds of things. But as outsiders, we build identity around these kinds of things. More things that make a city lovable. Being a bike-friendly city makes for a lovable city. And of course, part of it has to do with, biking means, okay, fewer cars, means we're better for the environment, we have healthier people. And, biking is fun, too. We forget that. But if you're a bike-friendly city, it actually says something at a very fundamental level. If you're a bike-friendly city, it actually says we're not all about the car. And think about how much of our city making and our city planning revolves around the car, right? We seem to be in service to the car. And sometimes we ask, really, where are the people in all of this? So if you're a bike-friendly city, you've at least said on a very sort of almost on a subtle level, but people feel it, that it's not just about the car. And by the way, if you're one of those bike-unfriendly cities, it actually says just the opposite. It says cars matter more than people. It says we're not very good on the environment, we're not very healthy, and we're not very much fun. So a bike-friendly city is a lovable city. And I actually took this picture yesterday up in Mountain View, and I thought, wow, you guys really are pretty hardy to be out there riding like that. So, and you know what? Honestly, some of the bike-friendliest cities in the world are very northern cities, lots of Scandinavian cities, Canadian cities as well. So I think this actually represents a pretty cool opportunity. Could we become a more bike-friendly city? Maybe we don't have to make bicycling magazines top whatever, but if we're just a little bit more bike-friendly, we at least start that conversation. We're moving forward with that. A walkable city is a lovable city for very similar reasons to the biking, the environment, the health, and the things like that. But walking allows for two really important things. It allows for improvisation and discovery. Think about it. When you're driving down the street at 45 miles an hour and you see a sign for a new shop, a new retail, whatever, new restaurant, do you stop? Probably not, because you have to go down, turn back around, find a place to park. But you maybe log it in the back of your head. Okay, I'll check that out later, right? And maybe you do, maybe you don't. But when you're walking, oh, this is new. I haven't been in here before. Check that out. Or I've never been down this street before. And think about how wonderful it is when we discover something new about maybe someone that we've known for a long time, an old friend. We discover something new about an old friend. It's like, I didn't know you went to clown college. Me too, you know. And isn't that kind of a wonderful thing when you discover something new about an old friend? Or think about this. How about when you discover something new about a city that maybe you've lived in all your life? Like, wow, I've discovered something in my own hometown. That doesn't happen at 45 miles an hour. It does happen when we figure out ways to get people out and walking a little bit more and finding out new things about their old neighborhoods. Good stuff. A dog-friendly city is a lovable city, and I understand that folks here in Anchorage love their dogs as well, and that's great. Of course, a dog-friendly city means you have things like dog parks and green space. That's cool, too. But with apologies to, you know, the cat owners, monkeys, ferrets, snakes, and things like that, the reality is we just don't walk our cats. We walk our dogs. And when we walk our dogs, we're actually creating something interesting. What developers and what city planners and folks are trying to create is this notion of vitality, activity on the street. Well, those people walking their dogs are creating that sense of activity and vitality, and that's a good thing. And by the way, there's other stuff that's happening, and tell me, you know, if you've had this experience, because, you know, when we walk down the street and you see another person, you know, maybe you go, hey, hey, and that's sort of the nature of, you know, the conversation. But if there's a dog in the mix, slightly different. You know, you're walking down the street, you see the dog, you smile at the dog, the dog wags its tail, you look at the owner, you smile at the owner, you say, oh, cute dog, the dog, you know, comes over to lick your hand. And there's a slightly different, you know, interaction that's going on there. That's social capital. You know, when we get beyond the hey, hey kind of thing, and we're actually, you know, engaging just a little bit, that is social capital. And when we're maybe in a neighborhood, chances are you're going to see that dog again and that owner again. And who knows what comes of that. But it's that small thing that dog helps to negotiate that's kind of critical. And by the way, in an era where we can ill afford more police and more surveillance equipment, dogs provide a much-needed aspect of safety. And it's not because my little puggle Buffy is a killer attack dog, you know, far from it. But what the simple fact is that when I'm out there walking her, I'm actually the eyes on the street that Jane Jacobs, the great urbanist, said creates our sense of safety. It's the eyes of strangers on the street that makes us feel safe. Because there's nothing worse than walking down a completely empty street, right? We feel very exposed when that's happening. But if there's dog walkers out there, we feel safe. We feel better. So maybe we ought to figure out a way to actually, you know, provide some tax incentives to move dog owners into some of the marginal neighborhoods and get them to sort of revitalize some kind of stuff. Not a bad idea. Not a completely wacky idea. Because dog-friendly cities do make for lovable cities. A youth-friendly city is a lovable city. And we all say how, you know, we want to be very family-oriented, family-friendly, and things like that. And that's very true. And certainly we want the young professionals to stay after they graduate college and things like that. But the question becomes, are we really sort of youth-friendly? And part of that has to do with accepting, you know, their music and their style and some things like that. So if you want to be a youth-friendly city, we have to start this conversation not when they're, you know, college graduates, you know, ready to leave, and it's like, hey, we'd really like you to stay. We've got to start this when they're much younger, maybe, you know, early teens and stuff like that, to have this conversation about getting them to love this city. And that means things like, you know, multi-age shows so they can, you know, places to listen to their music. And the tough one, skateboarding. And skateboarding is a huge bugaboo in most cities because, you know, it's like, no skateboarding, can't do this, can't do that. You know, the problem is when we're saying no, we think we're saying no to an activity. We're saying no to skateboarding. What they're actually hearing is when we say no to skateboarding, we're actually saying no to their culture. Think about that. Think about how much culture actually has evolved out of skateboarding. It's everything from fashion and music and art and this whole sense of community that goes with the activity of skateboarding. Think about that. We're saying no to an activity. They're hearing that as a repudiation of their culture. So we're saying no to them, and we want them to say yes to us further down the road. We have to find a way to accommodate some of this. And I know this is a huge tension in most cities, but if we can figure out a way to truly be youth-friendly, that's the makings for a more lovable city.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Kagayama, author of For the Love of Cities. He was recorded speaking at the For the Love of Anchorage workshop hosted by the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation on February 23rd.
In this process, there's a special role that creative people actually play in making these lovable cities. And in the book, I write about this notion of a co-creator. This is my friend Bob Devin Jones from St. Petersburg, Florida. He is the creative director of a small black box theater in downtown St. Petersburg. And Bob is one of the sort of central nodes of what makes St. Petersburg a great place to live, work, and play. but he doesn't show up on any sort of official city org chart. But he is one of those people, if we lost Bob, we lose all kinds of stuff that goes with the great stuff that he's doing. And I bet if we start thinking about these people, we probably know some of these people. There's probably, you probably are these people, these co-creators who are making the content that the rest of the city sort of consumes, as it were. And what if we were to lose some of those people? You know, if an anchor institution or an anchor business is about to leave, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that Bill and the city and his teams could, you know, apply to trying to keep folks here to stay. But if one of those people was about to leave, what do we do around that? You know, and I met some of those folks. I met Mao Tosi yesterday up in Mountain View. Do you guys know Mao? AK Pride is his project. He's now doing a bunch of stuff, but you know, interesting guy. And one of those people that probably doesn't show up in any sort of traditional sort of city org chart, but clearly is an important cog in what makes, you know, Anchorage and certainly what makes Mountain View a really dynamic place. You know, and I had a great time up there, and I wanted to thank Jewel and Carol from Cook Inlet and the Land Trust. I mean, the great stuff that's going on up there, and got us a chance to meet folks, you know, like Mao, the librarian who I met yesterday. She's doing amazing stuff. You can check out ukuleles at their library. Yes, I see her right over there. Thank you, Elizabeth. You can check out a ukulele. I thought that was really pretty cool. You know, I've never heard of that. It's like, you know, apparently because there's a Polynesian community there and because the ukulele has become cool. So if you really want to learn to play ukulele, you can actually check one out from Elizabeth's library up there in Mountain View. Now, this is another creative person. This is my friend Kate Dodrell. And Kate and a friend started this little project in Detroit called Soup. And once a month, they get people together at a restaurant. Everybody buys their own dinner, but at the door, everybody throws in $5 extra. And people who are interested in are looking for a little bit of funding for a creative project, they come up and they pitch during dinner. So they'll be, you know, people will be eating, and I'd be up here saying, "Hi, my name's Peter Kageyama. This is my project. This is why it's cool. This is why you should vote for me. Thanks very much." So everybody pitches, and then at the end of dinner, everybody votes. Winner gets the pot, $500, $600, $700, $800. No grant application required. Thank God. And, you know, while it's cool that, you know, because creative people can stretch, you know, that $500, $600, $700 like nobody's business. We know that. But there's actually something else that's really interesting that's happening there, is by bringing this creative community together, they're actually creating a whole new sense of possibilities. Because there's this myth that all the creative folks know each other, right? Oh, they all must hang out at the same coffee shops, right? No, it's really not the case. You maybe have the visual artists here, performing artists, digital artists over here, designers, things like that. They don't necessarily know each other. This is a way to bring them all together around the very human function of breaking bread. And introductions are made, possibilities happen. And that to me is the secret sauce of what Soup is actually trying to do. The $500 is nice, but bringing those folks together even more important. This is Candy Chang. She's an artist from New Orleans, and she's done a number of projects, but one of the first ones she did was this little simple stencil that says, "It's good to be here," in New Orleans, and using spray chalk, not spray paint, because that would be vandalism and that would be wrong, but spray chalk, because it washes off right there. She started painting this literally all over the city. And think about that statement, "It's good to be here," in the context of New Orleans, a city that people thought they had lost. That's a powerful statement. It's good to be here. And to be reminded of that over and over. As you walk down the street, you see this in front of restaurants, in front of different buildings. You see it on the sides of places. It's good to be here. That is a self-reinforcing kind of thing, done in a very simple way, but a very powerful kind of statement. It's good to be here. Another project she did was because there are so many abandoned properties. They are still in New Orleans. She created these little stickers, you know, like the name tags we often wear, and it says, "I wish this was," and invited people to actually write something on that. So this one was, "I wish this was a home. I wish this was owned by someone who cared. I wish this was full of nymphomaniacs with PhDs. I wish this was a grocery." And so what she did is she put these stickers out all around the community and invited people to essentially vote on what they wanted to see. And they did. And what you started to see happening was people would take these and they'd write stuff all over. And you start to see them on all these abandoned buildings. And you'd have some, you know, we pay a lot of money for sort of, you know, straw polls and focus groups and things like that. Well, people are voting very simply and very directly on these kinds of things. And even more important than that, if you're walking past an abandoned building and you see all of this stuff on those windows and on those walls, it says somebody cares. It says somebody actually gives a damn about this old, you know, building that maybe, you know, we can do better. Because too often we think, oh, so nobody cares about this stuff. Every time you walk past this stuff, you see somebody else cares. Again, a self-reinforcing kind of art project, and I think absolutely brilliant. This is Swings Tampa Bay. These are my friends Ruben and Hunter. Ruben's the airborne one there. Really simple idea that these guys actually started. They started hanging swings all around the city, sort of in just guerrilla fashion, all around Tampa Bay. So they'd, like at night, you know, they'd go down to the park, they'd find a tree, they'd hang the rope, they'd hang the swing, and then they'd paint it, you know, they'd painted the swings. Really simple thing, right? They said they did it because a swing is a spontaneous community building exercise. Because how can you not be happy when you're, you know, on a swing? And think about this, you're walking down the street, you're there with your significant other, you're there with your kids want to play on it, you put your girlfriend on the swing. Nice little moment, a simple little thing. And again, having fun. And I think what's kind of cool about this one was actually in this overpass. That one apparently didn't last very long. But to the city's credit, the mayor has said, you know, he loves what these guys are doing. He says, of course we have to pull them down, but you know what? We appreciate their energy, and the last thing we want to do is sort of squelch that enthusiasm. So he sort of said to these guys, hey, I love what you're doing. Keep it up. But we'll keep pulling them down. But, you know, we're going to have this sort of a detente. They haven't arrested them yet is really the main point. But again, something simple that these guys have, you know, they got some encouragement, and these guys are now on to other and bigger things. Small things like that, they can have this nice sort of growth potential, as it were, in a community. In Lexington, Kentucky, they have a combined sewer system like many cities in America, in the sense that rainwater and trash and all this stuff sort of flows into the same pipe. And if you had several hundred million dollars and infinite patience, you'd actually spend that money and time and fix all of your sewer, you know, systems, but most cities don't have the time or the patience to do that. So they put signs up there on there that says things like this, no dumping, you know, drains to streams, and don't throw trash down the sewers. But they actually took this a step further, and they hired an artist to go out and paint these storm drains, because the whole idea was to make them more visible so that, you know, you'd pay attention. And up here it says, made you look storm drain awareness. Now, storm drains is a really boring problem. I mean, it's an important problem, but it's a really boring problem. But they've taken a very creative approach to sort of helping to solve that. Now, is it fixing the fundamental problem? No, but it's addressing some of the symptoms and making it better in a creative way. The power of a coat of paint, by the way, never underestimate that. Because here in Portland, the neighborhoods, like many neighborhoods in America, you have people say, there's too many cars here, and they're driving through here way too fast, right? You guys probably have similar situations in neighborhoods. You want, and then you ask the city for traffic calming, and then they have to do a huge study, and it's a big pain in the ass, right? Well, the folks in Portland and City Repair, they sort of took it on themselves to do something kind of extraordinary. So what happens is when the neighborhoods decide, you know what, we want to do something about this, they call in these guys, City Repair, and they paint the intersections. They create these really cool designs, and they paint the intersection. And an amazing thing happens. The cars slow down. Now think about it. If you're driving down this street over here, and you're coming approaching, it's like you're driving. It's like, whoa, what the heck is that? You know, you see this yellow, green thing. It's like, whoa. So what do? You slow down, right? So you slow down. And when the cars slow down, now all of a sudden this whole intersection now comes back to life. Kids can now play there. Remember when we were kids, we could actually play in the street? Now, you know, you'd be arrested for being a bad parent if you allowed your kids to play in the street most of the time. But they've taken this back from the car just a little bit. And now this has become an area where actually the community gathers around this thing, the power of a coat of paint. Now, I have to tell you a story. Creative people and creative solutions to really some significant problems as well. In January of last year, Newsweek magazine came out with their list of America's 10 most dying cities. Most dying cities. And you can imagine no city wanted to be on that list. And it was based upon population loss between 2000 and 2010. And no surprise, New Orleans was the number one dying city there in America. But New Orleans, if you've not been back to New Orleans since Katrina, it's actually absolutely amazing. In many ways, I think it could be one of the most exciting cities in America because there's so much activity, so much is being rebuilt and reimagined in that city. So it's a really unfair thing to say they're a dying city. Far from it. Now, Grand Rapids, Michigan was also on that list. Now, what typically happens when somebody says something negative about your city, right? In traditional fashion, you'd say, well, we need to have a new ad campaign, we need to do a PR blitz, we need to get the word out that we are not a dying city, right? Well, most cities right now don't have a whole lot of money to be doing that kind of stuff. So Grand Rapids was sort of faced with a dilemma. Says, what the heck are we going to do? Are we going to live with this moniker? Because I don't think we have the tools and the resources to sort of reply in traditional fashion. In walks this 22-year-old kid. He's the guy in the green t-shirt. His name is Rob Bliss. He's a 22-year-old guy. He does social media for one of the local TV stations. He goes, I have an idea. And I can imagine the meeting kind of went something like this with sort of the traditional powers that be. He goes, we're going to do a lip dub. A lip what? Lip dub, L-I-P-D-U-B. A lip dub is people lip syncing to like a popular song. And we could do, and it's usually done as one continuous shot, by the way. So we could do a lip dub here today. We could pick a song, put it on play, everybody starts singing. We take the video camera here, we go here, back through here, done. Lip dub. Really boring lip dub, but a lip dub nonetheless. One continuous shot, lip syncing to a popular song. But he said, look, we're going to make the world's largest lip dub. We're going to get everybody in town that is willing to come out and play. We're going to make it huge. We're going to have it go all through downtown. We're going to put it up on YouTube. We're going to put it out there through social media. It'll be great. Now, think about that meeting. I'm sure there's something, you know, people go, powers that be, going, a lip what? Using Yoohoo, Twitter, social what? How old are you, son? And what's with your hair? Because Rob does not look like your traditional city solutions provider, right? He's not wearing a suit. He's not armed with all the sort of data and statistics that have said, oh, of course we've done this, you know, X number of times in other places with these, you know, these very calculated results. No. And to their credit, or maybe because they had to or they didn't have a whole lot of other choice, the city of Grand Rapids said, you know, let's try this. And they didn't have any money, but they did help, you know, they connected them with some private money and they raised about $40,000. And they helped by closing off some streets in downtown. And last May, they did the Grand Rapids Lip Dub. And it was pretty extraordinary. I've got an excerpt that I'm going to show to you. It's 9.5 minutes long in its entirety. I've got a much smaller version here. Again, think about it. One continuous shot. They had over 5,000 people participated in it. 5,000 people. It's amazing. That video has been viewed nearly 5 million times on YouTube. Got picked up by every national and international media source. Rob was interviewed on Good Morning America, and Grand Rapids has gotten literally tens of millions of dollars of positive brand exposure because they were willing to listen to a 22-year-old kid with a weird, untried, different idea. Think about that. The lesson is not necessarily to go out and do another lip dub. In fact, I would say don't do a lip dub because it's been done, and let's not be completely derivative out there. But the lesson of the lip dub is this, is that let's maybe listen to those weird and wacky ideas. And maybe the next time somebody who comes in who doesn't quite look like your traditional person who's going to come before your board, your organization, the city, and things like that, maybe let's give them a little bit more, let's listen a little bit more, because we may be losing the opportunity to do something really extraordinary. Maybe if we can help shape those ideas and get them to do something fairly extraordinary. As we were talking about last night, maybe we can't all be risk takers, but maybe we can support those who are willing to take those risks. And that, to me, is a fantastic example of a community really rallying behind that. And a big, you know, sort of, you know, FU to Newsweek magazine by coming up and saying something like this. And sometimes it takes that challenge from outside with somebody saying, you can't do it, or your kid is ugly, and you say, you rally around that. So I totally applaud what these guys have done. I think it's pretty extraordinary. So think about that. Maybe the next time the unconventional solution provider walks in your door, maybe we'll give them a little bit more time and attention. And the folks like Rob, the folks like, you know, like Bob Devin Jones, the folks like Mao Tosi, these people matter. They're these sort of, in some ways, they're the most powerful of spices that go into our community. And you don't necessarily need a lot of these spices. I'm no cook, but I know that you don't necessarily need a lot of the most powerful stuff to make a great meal. And I know this because Wikipedia tells me so. Not for the traditional reasons that you would think. Now, I imagine all of us here are familiar with or have used Wikipedia, right? Has anybody here ever made a Wikipedia entry? Yes, a couple folks. More than five? No. And I've done this talk in front of, you know, hundreds, up to 1,000 people at a time. And very rarely, you'll occasionally get one person who's maybe made more than five Wikipedia entries. The point about that is that Wikipedia, all of us have used it and we're familiar with that, but very few people have actually ever contributed to it. In fact, the studies show that less than 1% of the total number of users of Wikipedia have ever made an entry to the system. And yet we're talking about tens of millions of man hours in order to create all of that content, because that's entirely user-generated content, by the way. So think about that. Less than 1% of that community actually makes that entire community. Physical communities, I think, follow a very similar pattern. in the sense that a very small percentage of us actually make the community, that make the content that everybody else sort of consumes. Now, all of us consume our cities, right? And in return, typically, we pay our taxes, we spend our money, and we obey the law, right? That's sort of the deal, right? In return, the city provides us its resources, its infrastructure. But there's a small percentage of us who actually are creating that content that other people consume. The fact that you guys are here today, you are probably those co-creators in both official and unofficial capacity. And think about that. And this is a different approach to maybe talent attraction and retention. What would happen if we were to try to increase those co-creators by just by 0.1%? If we believe that 1% of our communities are actually making those communities, what would happen here in Anchorage? 291,000, which means there's about 2,900 people who are making the city happen. In Fairbanks, it's 31,000, which means there's 315 folks. And in Wasilla, there's 7,800 folks, which means there's 78 people who actually are making that city. And here in Anchorage, what if we were to add 291 more Maotoses, 291 more social entrepreneurs, people who start things, people who make stuff happen? That would have an exponential impact on the quality of life in this city for everyone. These content creators, these co-creators absolutely matter. And they're here. They're waiting. A lot of these folks just have the ideas, they have the excitement, they have the energy, they want to get in the game. We just haven't quite figured out how to do that. And what if we were to try to attract and retain more of these folks? That to me would be the new math in talent attraction and retention. And then you would see a completely marvelous, incredible impact in your own city. If we could just find a few more of these people to do some of the things that is already in their nature to want to do. New math of talent attraction and retention. Because right now, folks, there is a gap between the city that we desire and the city that we can afford. We all feel it. We all know it every day. Many of you are probably fighting those same budget battles yourselves. The question becomes, what do we do about it? Do we sort of sit back and sort of complain and wait for the city to get, you know, rich again so that they can satisfy our wants and needs? And in the meantime, we're going to write letters to the editor, we're going to think about moving, and basically sit on the sidelines and bitch, right? No, I think not. I think the question becomes, what can we do? How do we get ourselves in the game? And those people who are emotionally engaged, the ones who love a place, the ones who give a damn, we're going to have to step up and get in the game and do something above and beyond ordinary levels of citizenship. Because when we love something, we fight for it. We go above and beyond. And we forgive. We forgive. We forgive the shortcomings of those things that we love. And if we can figure out how to do this, how to get the human heart engaged in this process, I believe that will prove to be the most powerful tool of all in creating not just great livable cities, but creating very, very lovable cities. So, thank you very much. With that, that ends sort of the first half of our talk here today. I hope you guys have enjoyed that. I think where we're at right now, what time is it, Bill?
It is 10 till.
Okay, good timing. What we're going to do, we have some books here for sale. I'd love to chat with you guys and whatnot. What we're going to do is we're going to shift the room really quickly. We've got For the Love of Anchorage, which now we're going to put this back on you guys. And hopefully you guys have some ideas about how to make this a better, more interesting, more lovable place.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Peter Kageyama, co-founder and producer of the Creative Cities Summit and author of the book, For the Love of Cities. Peter Kageyama was the featured speaker at the For the Love of Anchorage workshop, hosted by the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation on Thursday, February 23rd. If you would like to see an artistic interpretation of Peter's talk, combined with the ideas from our community submitted by audience members, go to alaskapublic.org. There you'll find a time-lapse video of a mural built at the For the Love of Anchorage workshop. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.